I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Elizabeth Olson. Elizabeth is a vice president of design at Procter & Gamble, and she's also a board member for the Contemporary Arts Center. And we have something pretty exciting happening this week, Elizabeth. Maybe you can share what's going on.
I'd be delighted. On March 6th, we're bringing about six artists in to have a one-day conference at the Contemporary Arts Center. The name of the conference is Off Online Flash Film Festival. I hope I have that right. And it's a real expression of design and art as it comes to life in the digital media. So the conference will include presentations from these speakers. Some are more hands-on in kind of an illustrative approach, all the way to movies, to commercials and video. Some that's more exploratory and cutting edge, as well as some really beautiful commercial work that you might recognize and wonder whoever did that. So it's a really wonderful cross-section of artists that you might not normally see. This is our second year having it, and when we had it last year, we had a sellout crowd and with a waiting list, which is why we've moved from the Contemporary Arts Center to the Aronoff so that we've got a little more space.
And then the grand opening, if you can't make it on Wednesday, the opening is on March 8th.
Yes, on Friday we have an exhibition, as you might guess, named On, where we will be celebrating both artists that presented last year as well as some of the artists that present this year. So you'll get to both see them in person if you can buy your tickets soon and go to the conference on Wednesday, or see their work in the galleries March 8th, and then the exhibit hangs for a while after that.
Relevance, or why is it important to our region, Elizabeth, for this area to be chosen for events like Off?
You know, I think if you read any of the social studies, you hear about the creative class. And if you read anything about business, you hear about innovation. And at P&G, where I get my day work done, innovation's really important. And I'm a member of the design community at P&G. So creativity and innovation are really important skills and factors to have in people's lives so that they can have new ideas about how to design products or experiences.
Well, and especially this whole area is being promoted as a design hub, right?
Yes. There's a lot more, you know, I'm often amused or sometimes saddened about the self-deprecating attitude that I think the community can have. There's a lot of really great creative activity that goes on here, whether it's the design school up the hill, the number of really world-class design firms and agencies that we have, both digital as well as conventional, and the number of really big clients. So there's a lot of creativity. And then there's I'm sure you've covered things like the Brandery and Centrifuge about other approaches to creativity and innovation in the area. So this is just another lens on it. And I think it's part of really creating a vibrant creative community that attracts people so that we have the talent that we have here and so that the talent that we have stays.
And this is a way for some of that talent to interact with each other.
Oh, you're exactly right. So some of it is what you see on the screen, but I think just as important is the other people who are sitting next to you having a shared experience and making perhaps some unlikely connections, either about your work or just in how you might inspire each other or other artists that you can learn about from each other. So part of it's the presenters and part of it's the audience.
So again, the conference is on March 6th. The grand opening is on
Friday, March 8th at the Contemporary Arts Center.
And if people want information or tickets, they can go to
the CAC website. They can go to the Aronoff if they want tickets to the conference, or they could call 621-ARTS if they want to do it over the phone.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Elizabeth Olson. Elizabeth is the Vice President of Design for Procter & Gamble and also a board member at the Cincinnati Contemporary Arts Center. And Elizabeth, the CAC is sponsoring a conference on March 6th, bringing in the OFF conference. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a wonderful one-day event that has about six speakers that are demonstrating art as it's expressed through the digital media. Some of it is static, that is, illustrations that don't move, all the way to live action and special effects in the motion picture and video realm. It's six presenters in the course of the day, and then it's followed 2 days later by an opening, appropriately enough called On, that opens at the Contemporary Arts Center on Friday, March 8th.
Why does this Contemporary Arts Center get interested in bringing in a show like a conference and a show like this?
One of the missions, or probably the primary mission of the Contemporary Art Center, is to really act as kind of a navigator of culture for the curious and to bring ideas and experiences that you otherwise might not have thought of or sought out and bring them so that you can experience them and learn something new, experience something different, or have a different conversation than you might have either with other people who attend or at your dinner table. And so it's under that auspice of really bringing new thought-provoking experiences to the city that this event really fits with the CAC mission. As many museums do, we have docents. We have a very passionate and devoted group of docents that will help provide some context about not only why you might like this work, but why it's significant or what's noteworthy about it or what new idea is represented in it. And in fact, we're very excited. We've just recently equipped them with iPads so that they have access to more information if you wanted to know more about the artist. Or there are what they call didactics, you know, the texts that you see on the wall that are there to kind of give you some context, but the docents can provide additional information.
So, Elizabeth, the range of listeners is well outside of the Cincinnati area, folks all the way to Charleston, West Virginia, Dayton, Lexington. What would you say to someone listening today who has never been to the Contemporary Arts Center, doesn't really know what that is? They could come in and actually plan a visit to Cincinnati and take the opportunity to look through the Arts Center.
Yes, we would really love them to do that. In fact, even this conference has people from Canada as well as Texas and other parts of the U.S. rather than go to Barcelona from where the conference was originated. But on an ongoing basis, the CAC has a website so that you can see what exhibits are being hung. And it provides a broad cross-section. Like we have a show up right now that's Andy Warhol through some of his photography. So it may be an artist, let's say in that case, where it's somebody you've known, but you'll get a different view on their work or a different view on the context that they created in. And yet the latest show that opened is two artists from India. And interestingly, in India, there is not a museum construct for artists to hang. And it's really private homes, private collectors. So obviously, it's not going to be an artist that you are likely to see. But the CAC kind of curates, seeks that out and brings it forward so that you can be exposed to new artists and new ideas, new techniques. You know, you may not like all of it, but at the very least, you get a new view on the world, if not just on art. You get some new ideas and maybe share that experience with other people too.
So again, if folks would like more information about the conference, about the Contemporary Arts Center, what's the website?
The Contemporary Arts Center has their website. If you want tickets to the conference, you can get them at the Aronoff or 621 Arts.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom and I do tax chats for the Enquirer throughout the tax season, and our next chat's actually coming up on March the 9th and again on the 23rd of March. But we've had a couple of them already, and we want to talk about some of the issues, some of the questions that the folks who have written us or talked to us on the tax chats.
Well, and if you do have a question that you want to directly ask us, you can log into our tax chat. It's always on Cincinnati.com between 9 and 11 on Saturdays.
So, Tom, one of the people on the tax chat had actually asked a question about over-contributions to the Roth IRA, and that's a no-no.
It is a no-no, but the question really was they'd already done it inadvertently. They had over-contributed, and in this particular case, the guy actually was paying an excise tax for his over-contribution in 2012 and wanted to know if he needed to take the money out or what he should do about it to avoid an excise tax in 2013. And really, you have up until April 15th of the following year to correct an over-contribution. So really, if you have an over-contribution for 2012, if you just redesignate that overage as a 2013 contribution by April 15th, it solves the problem and you get out of the excise tax.
Another issue that was somewhat in limbo there for a while was the 0% capital gain tax rates. And a few years ago, there was a provision that was added that allowed people in the 15% tax bracket or less could pay 0% capital gains. And that did get extended to 2012. So if you can qualify, that's certainly something that you want to take a look at. And also, it's going to apply for 2013.
Yeah, and that generally applies to people who are in either the 0, the 10, or the 15% tax bracket.
Speaking of capital gains, let's talk about reinvested dividends, because many times people pay too much tax on capital gains, because they don't factor in or take into account the amount of reinvested dividends that adds to their cost basis.
Yeah, for instance, you put $10,000 into a mutual fund. 20 years later, you sell the mutual fund for $30,000. You may not have much of a gain at all, assuming that you've had dividends reinvested, because that creates additional basis, and your basis would be calculated by adding all those dividends to your original basis. In many cases, the mutual fund company will keep track of your cost basis, but some of them don't go back far enough to totally keep that historical cost.
Many people are paying college tuition, and this one individual had a question about a 1098-T that his son had received from college. It actually showed a $5,100 amount in the grants and scholarship box. And the question was, do they have to declare that as income on their tax return?
Yeah, and that's a question we get frequently, because I think it's very confusing to people, because they get this form 1098-T in the mail, which the colleges are required to send, and it shows how much you paid in tuition and fees, and it also shows how much scholarship you were awarded. And the purpose for knowing the scholarship amount is because you can't take a deduction or get a credit for costs that were reimbursed through the scholarship, but it's not in and of itself income to the student.
The other thing that I think people aren't aware of is that when you do pay tuition and you use a loan to do that, that the loan amount is still considered a type of payment that would qualify you for education tax credits. Just because you've used loan money to pay tuition, that still counts for purposes of all of the education tax credits and the tuition deduction if you're eligible for that.
Right. And depending on your level of income, you may even be able to deduct the interest on the loan.
Again, if you'd like to join us for our upcoming tax chats, the next one will be on March 9th from 9 until 11, same on March 23rd at Cincinnati.com. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Well, Crystal, it's that time of year when we've started doing our tax chats for the Inquirer on Cincinnati.com. And it's sometimes useful to repeat some of the questions we get, because some of them are common questions that a lot of people have. And one we got in our recent tax chat had to do with the father of a college student who had taken an internship in another state, and he was wondering if his child would have to file a tax return in that state or if they were just considered a resident of Ohio. The practical answer to that was there withholding in the other state? Because if there was, you're going to have to file in both states just to claim the withholding.
That's right. And unless it's a reciprocal type of arrangement between the states, generally you are going to have to file in both states if you live in one state and work in another. The key is you should be able to get a tax credit on your state of residence for any tax paid to other states. So you just have to be aware. It gets a little complicated, but something that you can take advantage of in terms of getting the credit for taxes paid elsewhere.
And normally the reciprocal states are border states, such as Ohio and Kentucky, or Ohio and Indiana, where people cross the border to go to work on a daily basis.
Another issue that people have had this past year, certainly, and we got a question about this, is a couple had gotten divorced. And the question was, how do they go about claiming their children? What do they do in terms of filing status if they got divorced in 2012?
Well, and typically, how you claim your children is spelled out in the divorce agreement. So you have to follow that. And typically, you have to include a form with the agreement that authorizes the non-custodial parent to claim the exemption if that's what's being done.
Yeah, there are very specific rules about who can claim a child as a dependent when you're divorced. So you really want to take a look at that. You can take a look at the publication at IRS.gov. The other issue was, how do they file their tax returns if they got divorced mid-year? And bottom line there is, whatever your filing status was on the last day of the year dictates your filing status in terms of whether you can file jointly, separately, or head as household.
Yes, and if you got divorced in the year and were smart enough not to get remarried in that same year, then you would presumably file either single or head of household.
So again, you can file head of household if you can qualify. You just have to know the rules, and they are somewhat complicated. So make sure you take advantage of that filing status if you can, because you can save a lot of tax. The tax rates are cheaper using head of household most generally.
We also frequently get questions in the case of a divorce about how you allocate the deductions in the year of the divorce, you know, the first year that you're filing separately. And that allocation is typically done based upon the facts. If the funds came out of a joint account, it's either split in half for each spouse or proportionate to who contributed to that account. based on income, for instance. Or sometimes the mortgage may be only in one spouse's name and they paid all the mortgage and they might be entitled to the entire deduction.
One individual had a timeshare, and in 2012, they did not use that timeshare personally. They rented it, and they were wondering whether or not that income was taxable.
And there's a rule in the tax code that allows you to exclude income from rentals if the unit was rented for less than 14 days. So in this case, it was a one-week timeshare, and so they fall under that exclusion, and so they were allowed to avoid reporting that income.
Again, if you'd like to join us for our upcoming tax chats, the next one will be on March 9th, and the final one on March 23rd between 9 and 11 a.m. on Cincinnati.com. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Maureen Kennedy. Maureen is the director and choreographer, and she's the founder of the Irish Heritage Center, along with your partner and husband. So, Maureen, you've been a performer, an actor, a dancer all of your life. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it, to be able to really express yourself in the form of dance?
It's fabulous. It's a really blessing to be able to do what you love, and I've done it my whole life. In fact, when I was 3 years old, I was creating plays out of rewriting Winnie the Pooh and directing the kids in the neighborhood, and I never stopped. I'm still doing it.
You were actually a performer, a dancer throughout your life, weren't you?
I did. That's what I always did. In fact, I helped pay for my high school and Catholic college education by teaching dance. And I was a theater major in college. As I got older, I moved into more directing and more choreographing, and still doing that today.
And you founded the Irish Heritage Center. How long ago was that?
That was 3 years ago now, yes.
It's amazing. And it's this amazing building down on...
It's on Eastern Avenue in Columbia Tuscan.
Mm-hmm. And you're about to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, which I know in my family, being married to an Irishman named Cooney, it's a big day. And it's got to be a big day in your life as well.
It's fantastic. I mean, it is a huge, huge month for us. And we start with the 14th of March. We're bringing in this wonderful group from Ireland, Derek Warfield and the Young Wolf Tones. They're very vivacious, and they sing the stories of Ireland in a great musical way. And then the 16th and the 17th of March, that's our big celebrations. The 16th is the St. Patrick's Day Parade downtown Cincinnati. And starting at noon at the Irish Heritage Center on Eastern Avenue, we have Irish food. We have the Guinness stew. We have shepherd's pie, corned beef and cabbage.
Sounds
and
wonderful.
All the entertainment starts. The dancers, the singers, the storytellers, everything.
So how do people find out when all these various activities are occurring?
Well, we have a website, and it lists everything, who's playing when the Erickson dancers are on, when the different musical groups, the storytellers, and it's on for the 16th and the 17th of March. And in fact, this year, on the 17th of March, we have a special Irish priest coming in, and he's saying the Mass at 11 in the morning, because it's a Sunday, the 17th, and part of it will be in Irish, and part of it will be in English.
So you mentioned earlier that the Heritage Center is down in Columbia, Tuscan.
It is.
How has that area received having this organization there?
Well, it's been wonderful. First of all, when we started off, you know, we are a not-for-profit and all-volunteer organization. The business owners and the neighborhood who live there, they came together and they helped us clean up when we had our first day of getting the center ready to open it up. And since we've been there, over the 3 years, there's been several businesses that have moved in.
Oh, wow.
Some of the buildings that were vacant are now housing great different groups.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Riley School of Irish Music, the Erickson Academy of Irish Dance. So we have the Columbia Tusculum Arts Corridor now in mm-hmm. that area, and it's getting better every day. There's people moving in all the time, renovating the buildings and creating a beautiful district.
Where do you see the center going?
Well, I see that the center will get even bigger and better. We bring in groups about four times a year from Ireland, and we bring in exhibits from the National Library of Ireland. I see more of that happening, and I see more classes. We have classes now in Irish dance, Irish music, Irish language, Irish history, and I think we'll have even more classes of that. The library is getting really developed. We have over 1,000 books now, and I think there's more coming in every day. The museum is happening, and not only is the museum about Ireland and Irish history, but now we have the Irish in America and the Irish in Cincinnati, so that is developing greatly.
Maureen, once again, if folks are interested in learning more about what is going on at the Irish Heritage Center, what's your contact information?
www.irishcenterofcincinnati.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Maureen Kennedy. Maureen is a director, she's a dancer, she's a performer her whole life. And a few years ago, she and her husband, Kent Covey, founded the Irish Heritage Center in Columbia Tusculum right here in Cincinnati. And Maureen, we have a lot of Irish history here in Cincinnati, don't we?
We do, we do. And I must say that I am filled with love and passion for Ireland, and that is one of the reasons why we have an Irish center. I mean, not only myself and my husband, but all the volunteers. It's a total volunteer organization. But in the 1700s, the Irish came into Cincinnati, and they came up on flat boats up the river, and they actually settled in the area around Columbia Tusculum.
Where the center is.
Yes, they did. And that was really great. They started out, you know, in a small little hut. The first school teacher was an Irishman, and he was in a dirt floor little cottage that he taught classes in, and it developed into really wonderful things. I mean, Cincinnati is a great city, and a lot of its greatness come from the Irish.
You know, it's interesting. I think Cincinnati has this German heritage aspect. People think of it as German, but there are a lot of Irish people here.
There are. About 30% of the population is Irish.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And when you think of Procter & Gamble, I mean, they were both married to Irish women. Procter was, you know, from Ireland. And, you know, the churches, the schools, the hospitals mm-hmm. founded by Irish nuns and the Bishop Purcell, you know, started the schools. Just so many things were done by the Irishmen and still are here in Cincinnati. It's a great group, very, very family orientated, and a group that loves its heritage and is proud of everything that Ireland is and will be in the future. And that's why we have an Irish Heritage Center.
I was going to say, it's just such a vision for you to have actually taken all of that history and you're really using that as an opportunity to share with people about their Irish heritage down at the Irish Heritage Center.
It is wonderful. I mean, I really am sad every time I leave Ireland. And finally, you know, we decided, okay, let's start an Irish Heritage Center. And now we have things like we have a beautiful thatched roof. So outside our Irish pub, it looks like a thatched roof cottage done by a local Irishman, William Cahill, who is a number one thatcher from Wexford, Ireland, now living in the Cincinnati area. It's just beautiful. He created that as one of his volunteer projects to help us.
So can people just come down into the Irish Heritage Center, just stroll, visit, learn?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we have exhibits all the time. Right now, we have the American Celtic Artists exhibit, which is on the walls. It's been traveling around the United States for 12 years. Now it's here at the Irish Heritage Center.
And certainly St. Patrick's Day is right around the corner.
We have the best St. Patrick's Day. In fact, we've had many people from Ireland who now are in the city or visiting the city over the past 3 years who said that our St. Patrick's Day is just like being in Ireland. And we not only celebrate on St. Patrick's Day, we also celebrate on the Parade Day, which is the 16th of March, the day before. And then on the 14th of March, we're bringing in a wonderful group from Ireland. They've played at Carnegie Hall and New York City, and now they're going to be at the Irish Heritage Center on a Thursday night, you know, for our people.
That is so great, Maureen. If people would like to learn more, would like to get information on the activities and what they may want to participate in, what's your contact information?
They should go on our website. It's IrishCenterOfCincinnati.com.
And does that also go for folks who just may want to volunteer or get involved?
Absolutely. And everybody is welcome. I mean, you don't have to be Irish to come to the Irish Center. You just have to want to have a good time.
That sounds wonderful. And
yes.
Again, it's the Irish...
The IrishCenterOfCincinnati.com, www.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Chris Finney, the president of the law firm Finney, Stagnaro, Saba, and Patterson. And Chris, I know your firm historically has done a lot of work with property valuations for appealing property tax. And I know in Hamilton County alone, there's been billions of dollars of value eroded in their tax base. But yet there are still some properties that are probably overvalued compared to today's value. And there's a certain time period you have to go through if you want to appeal your current
property tax value, isn't there?
In Ohio, March 31st is the deadline each year. So the tax bill that you get in January is for the first half of last year, the first half of 12, but you have to appeal that by March the 31st. Actually, it's April 1st this year because March 31st falls on a Sunday. And if you miss that deadline, you can't appeal till the next year. There's no exceptions. And the idea is that your property tax bill is a product of multiplying the tax rate, which is what the school district and the city decide you're going to pay in taxes, but that's times your valuation. And whether you have a single family home or a large business property, that valuation is a subjective determination by the auditor, and he makes mistakes. So there's a very simple process that we help people with that allows people to get their taxes reduced by challenging that value. Last year, I got introduced to a client that had a huge warehouse, 8 football fields under roof. And they said, would you look at our taxes for us? Well, we looked at it and we ascertained that their value was about 30, 40% high. We got their valuation down from about $18 million to about $13 million, saving them on the order of $250,000 a year of real estate taxes every single year. And had they not gone through this process, they'd still be paying that today. So they got a refund check last year for that amount. And every year from now on, they'll get reduced taxes in that amount.
And that's one happy client, isn't it?
Very happy client, by the way, when you can bring a client $250,000 refund check. But the same thing happens with single family homeowners. If you've got a $300,000 house in today's market, you know, that may really only be worth 2.25. Well, saving $75,000 on your valuation, I think if I do the math correctly, is about $1,500 to $2,000 a year of taxes. And it's a renewable resource, so every year you shave that off your tax bills. So what we recommend clients do, particularly those who have, let's say you own a bunch of restaurants or a bunch of apartment buildings or whatever, is look at your whole portfolio and try to get it righted. Even if you have to invest some money to get it fixed the first year, every year thereafter, you're going to trim your tax bill and keep that expense. It's like putting insulation in your attic. You know, there's a one-time expense to doing that, but every month you're going to get your utility bill down.
So can you take a look at, say, a property and just kind of off the top of your head see if it's something that could be a potential savings? Or how do you go about that? Let's just say someone maybe doesn't want to face the fact that their property has gone down in value, but it probably has.
Yeah, and that's something a little bit hard for people to swallow, but we're not taking value away, of course. We're just trying to save them money while they own it. But yeah, what our firm has done is we have put together what I call a pre-val team. We do pre-valuations of a property. All a client has to do is give me an address. If it's an income-producing property, we need their profit and loss statement. And they quickly will tell me this is worth maybe $110 a foot. The auditor has it on for $140 a foot. You know, there's X dollars of savings here. And then we'll make a proposal to a client of how we can go in and get that for them. But we'll do the pre-val, the initial analysis with no obligation, no charge. And then they can decide if they want to proceed.
Chris, if folks listening would like to contact you or your firm, what is your contact information?
It's Chris at chrisfinney.com. C-H-R-I-S at Chris Finney, F-I-N-N-E-Y.com. And my phone number is 513-533-2980.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Chris Finney. Chris is the president of the law firm Finney, Stagnaro, Saba, and Patterson. And Chris, I know you do a lot of work in the real estate area, but kind of on the side, you're involved in government issues, both locally and I think you also follow the national scene. What do you think is going to happen here in the next few months with this so-called fiscal cliff, the sequestration, or whatever they want to call it, with our federal budget?
Yeah, there are several things that Congress sort of keeps slow rolling and not making the decisions on. But at some point, whether we have a crisis like we did in the fall of 2008, or because they get some wisdom in Washington, they're going to have to deal with these things. In rough numbers, our Congress spends about $3 trillion a year, of which $2 trillion is actual revenue and $1 trillion is debt. And that's unsustainable. Just to give you an example, we currently only pay about $220 billion a year of interest on the federal debt, which is 6% of our budget. That's going to go up by a factor of 5 times in the next 5 to 10 years. So we're going to end up having interest on the federal debt of over $1 trillion before the end of the decade. It really becomes unmanageable. And this is not imaginary, and it's not this idea we can push off forever. It's a very real problem. they've been wrestling in Washington with who's going to take the leap first. The House has recently passed an extension of the debt limit. I think it's through the middle of March, on the condition that the Senate actually pass a budget, which they refused to do for the last 3 years, which will sort of have the two starting points, the House budget and the Senate budget. The second thing that happened is Speaker Boehner this last week promised to produce a budget blueprint from the Republicans that will balance the budget within 10 years. Now, that doesn't sound that ambitious, but as far out of budget as it is, that's remarkable. So there appear to be some hope with Republicans in Congress who seem serious about this, the Senate Democrats who finally said that they're willing to come to the table and really talk about it, that we might have a real honest discussion as a nation about this. But Crystal and Tom, I know you've got a son and daughter that are about my kids' ages. Your daughter's a little bit younger. They're going to be the ones that are going to be paying this $1 trillion a year of interest on the debt that we're accruing, and it's going to go up more.
As a society and our demographic, really, have created this mess that our children are going to have to solve.
I was with Dr. Winstrup, our new congressman, the other day, and he referred to all of us here at our age as the most selfish generation ever in the history of this nation. But if you look at what we've done for the last 40 years to the legacy that we left our children, it's really unfortunate. The good news is somehow we've gotten past the crisis of 08. We have a breather here where we can start to try to fix things. But if our leaders in Washington really don't take it seriously, they keep printing money, the consequences, I think, could be fairly dramatic for the next generation and maybe even ours.
How do you take politics out of the conversation? I think that's what so many people are so frustrated about.
Well, I think it's a good question, but I think that there's something much more than politics that's driving this, which is the money game in Washington, and both parties play it. The reality is, when you look at the votes, when you look at what they actually do, we're spending more under this Republican House, this Democrat Senate, than we ever have before, and they're doing nothing to rein that in.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Mary Hurlbut. Mary is the Community Outreach Coordinator for Lifespan Credit Counseling. And Mary, a lot of people have debit cards, credit cards. What do you recommend?
Oh, it's going to be different for everybody, Crystal. More people are using debit cards today than credit cards. And that's just happened within the last couple of years. They're using debit cards instead of cash or checks, and sometimes instead of credit, because they can keep better track. But if an error is made, if someone takes your information and steals it and takes money, it's coming right out of your checking account. You don't have the same protections that you have if it was a credit card. You'll never be responsible for more than $50 with a credit card. That is the law, as long as you let them know that someone stole your card. With a debit card, it's a little fuzzier. You will probably get your money back if someone stole the card. The bank is going to eat that. But you may not get it back for a month, 2 months. Your mortgage payment may bounce in the meantime because your checking account has been cleared out. So if you're going to use a debit card, the number one thing is it never leaves your sight. So when you go out to dinner, you don't hand it to the waiter who's going to the back room. I have a friend whose information was stolen, and all he did was hand it through the fast food restaurant window. By the time he got home, his bank was calling him and asking if he was trying to make a $2,000 purchase out of the country.
Well, as long as you have a good, secure PIN number, like, for instance, your birthday, you're okay, right?
He's being facetious, Mary.
Yeah. Oh, it's easy for others to steal. You don't want to put your PIN in when you're going through the grocery store. Somebody can be behind you and copying your PIN, memorizing your PIN number.
Well, back to your point, you don't give the server at the restaurant your debit card. Does that same advice go for credit cards? Because they have to take it and swipe it?
They have to take it and swipe it. But with your credit card, remember, you have protections. So you get your credit card statement and you say, hey, you know, I only ate at that restaurant once and they've charged me twice. You call your credit card company, they investigate for you. We had to do that. They issued us a new card. Within 24 hours, we had a new card. They investigated and it was only a $57 purchase. You know, you might have just let it go. But they investigated. We never had to pay it. Mm-hmm. And we had new cards immediately.
Yeah, my credit card was actually, the credit card company actually called me because somebody was using my, they weren't using my credit card, but they were using my number in Illinois, and I was in Cincinnati. But they caught it. They must have some program that shows
they
activity.
Do. In fact, we advise everybody now, if you're going on vacation, be sure to call your credit card company and let them know because they may not honor it.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about how you teach a student to use a debit card wisely.
Okay, a debit card is not cash, although they use it like cash. If I were giving a student a debit card, first of all, they need to learn how the banking system works, that when they swipe, that money's coming right out. But when you return an item, might take a week. Meanwhile, you do not have access to that. If you swipe your card at the gas pump, they will hold only a dollar until the final sale goes through a couple of days later. But the student has to remember that money is out. I tell everybody who uses debit cards, you have got to log on to your account at least once a day. And with the use of cell phones today, we've talked about that, you can check your account all the time. It's safer today than it once was. But they need to be constantly vigilant about what's in their account and what's available, not just what they think is in there.
If folks listening would like to contact you, what is your telephone number?
Oh, just call me directly, 513-476-6096.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Kate Keller. Kate is the Senior Program Officer for the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati. And, you know, Kate, healthcare is certainly an issue that impacts all of us, and it's changing so rapidly. What do you see some of the trends coming that will actually affect us as we move forward?
I see the healthcare system moving in a way of focusing on earlier intervention and health and wellness, and really being focused on individual patient care need, improving quality, reducing cost. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act picked up some trends that were already happening in the healthcare system, many of which were being piloted in Cincinnati, and launched them sort of across the nation to do more piloting work on how to provide better patient care and save money at the same time. One of the things that you'll see, and your doctor may be one already, is what's called a patient-centered medical home. And it's actually a credentialing process. And a patient-centered medical home is just that. It's patient-centered. It's about you and making sure your care meets all of your needs, not maybe just your medical needs, but sort of your whole body, whole health needs. There'll be different ways that your primary care provider will act more as a coordinator for you if you have other issues and working with other doctors. Again, the goal of reducing duplication of tests, making sure that everyone's on the same page when you're getting your care, and also making sure that you have the information you need to make decisions. So most patient-centered medical homes have an electronic health record that you can access online from anywhere. So you can communicate electronically with your doctor as well.
It seems like that's a long time coming. You have different doctors for different issues.
Yeah.
And to be able to actually coordinate that to better your overall health just makes all kinds of sense.
Well, the sharing of health information is a very protected thing. So keeping that information safe has been one of the limits against this kind of work happening in the past. But the technology that we've got in place today allows that to happen in a way that's safe and protects your information.
Let me just ask you another question, because the thing that I've never understood is, frankly, the way that medical professionals reimburse. They're reimbursed to help people who are already sick. Why is it that we as a society don't pay people to keep us well? It seems like it'd be a lot less expensive.
That is true. And I think we'll see some movement in that over the next 10 years. Payment for medical services are going to stop being fee for service. So every time they test you or see you, they get paid. So it incentivizes the health industry to see you a lot, generate funding. So their goals now would be to pay on what they call bundled payments. They get a set amount of payment to treat a certain issue, and they have to meet certain health outcomes. There are also other incentives inside the healthcare system to keep you out of the hospital. So if they can keep you out of the hospital and in better health, then they can also make money. So it's changing the incentives and how our system works.
And how's that being received?
I don't know if we know yet. I think the healthcare system is excited about the transition. They want to provide the best quality care they can, and they're looking for the best way to do that. And I think there's still a lot of unknowns, and people are sort of nervous about it. But I do think there's an excitement about changing how we function in the healthcare system.
Do you think this uncertainty about healthcare is limiting or reducing the number of young people who are getting into the healthcare profession just because they don't know what's coming at them?
I suppose that could be. My conversations with our medical schools is that they really haven't seen that. It will make an impact on where people decide to practice, but we still have, you know, people signing up to become nurse practitioners and other kind of healthcare providers. So it is a concern that we, you know, to make sure we have enough people in the workforce, as everybody has insurance and the population ages. But I think that the system's aware of that and they're working on it.
If people listening today would like more information about the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati or anything we talked about as it relates to health insurance exchanges, what's your website?
It's reform.healthfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate.